KQED.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. The bubonic plague is typically associated with Europe in the Middle Ages, but historian David K. Randall's Black Death at the Golden Gate explores a little-known chapter in the disease's history. Its near spread from San Francisco to the rest of the United States in 1900. David Randall joins us this segment to talk about the story, how racism influenced the response by authorities, and what it reveals about life in the Bay Area at the turn of the last century. David Randall is a senior reporter at Reuters based in New York, and Black Death at the Golden Gate is his third book. And welcome, David.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
Glad to have you here. This story starts kind of in Honolulu, really. Let's go back there.
Exactly. So this is the turn of the 20th century. Bubonic plague is once again spreading throughout the world. Everybody knows, you know, the story of Europe, how it decimated Europe in the Middle Ages. Most people don't know that it threatened the world again at the turn of the 20th century. 10 million people died in China. Another 5 million died in India. And it started spreading throughout the world.
They're dying in Mongolia as we speak now, in fact, of bubonic plague. Yeah.
Exactly. Russia had to close its border last week because of it. It seemed like only a matter of time before the disease reached North America for the first time. So the story I wrote about was about the small team of doctors who had to try to prevent the disease from killing millions across the U.S.
Well, 1900, there was the death of a Chinese immigrant, Wong Chut-king. City health officials saw this as really a possible likelihood of it spreading. They saw it, first of all, let's just talk about what swollen lymph. A black lymph is why they call it the black plague, in fact. Yeah,
exactly. So it's called a bubo, and that's usually a swollen lymph node in your groin or in your armpits. That's what gives the bubonic plague its name. That is one of three forms of the disease. There can also be septicemic, which is in your blood, or the most virulent is the pneumatic plague, which is spread just by coughing. And that's the form that really decimated Europe.
Well, it was in his groin, though, right?
Yeah, it was.
Okay, so what do they do? They quarantine Chinatown.
They do. That night, they string up ropes around the neighborhood. But then almost as quickly as they try to put in this response, the city and state officials try to backpedal right away. Nobody wants to admit the truth that the plague is here.
Well, it's not only a concern about the truth of it. It's the feeling that, well, I mean, let's just go into the weeds here for a moment, because we're talking about a lot of cover-up and corruption and racism.
Exactly. So this was a time when it was very blatant anti-Chinese, anti-immigrant.
Before the Chinese exclusion, or right after the Chinese exclusion.
Yeah, this is right at that same era. So, you know, Chinese immigrants, they can't become citizens, they can't own property, all these other things. So the whole community is clustered in, you know, 12 blocks or so of Chinatown. And at the same time, this is also an era when science and medicine does not necessarily have the legitimacy that it does now. This is right in the lifetime where what was considered being a good doctor was somebody who was really fast because there's not much pain medication available, to the era where you think of medicine as, you know, doctors in lab coats with microscopes and x-rays and all of that.
Talk about doctors being fast. Talk about that doctor on a bicycle getting out of Chinatown.
So that was in Honolulu. This was the
Chinatown, Honolulu.
Chinatown,
yeah.
Honolulu. This was one of the first. He was the first one who saw the first plague victim in Honolulu. He alerts the authorities. They string up again. They quarantine Chinatown. There's a near riot, and you know everybody starts trying to attack him because they see this is somebody who almost, you know, upended their lives. He escapes on a bicycle. Many people in Chinatown are taken to barracks, which is essentially a makeshift prison, and they ended up accidentally burning Chinatown in Honolulu to the ground. And that is one of the big fears of people living in Chinatown in San Francisco once the disease is here, is that they fear that that's also their lives are going to be upended in the same way.
In Honolulu, they're actually hiding children out of fear of white health officials. But then we have a white health official who's a hero in your story here in Chinatown in San Francisco, Rupert Blue, and realized really not only the extent of the plague, but what needed to be done.
Exactly. So he comes in after another health official by the name of Joseph Kenyon, who actually is one of the most brilliant doctors in the U.S. at the time, knows more about plague than anybody else. He's essentially run out of town because he is so aggressive that nobody trusts him. And he almost has this ability and talent at making people hate him. Then they bring in Rupert Blue, who is, you know, where Kenyon is thought of as brilliant, Rupert Blue is thought of as kind of lazy, but his talent is making people like him and trust him. So he's the first one who demonstrates that it's the fleas on rats that are spreading the disease. And he's also the first one who starts working with the Chinese community who are on the front lines to as treating them as full partners and not treating them with the same bigotry that, Kenyon did.
There's some amazing photographs here. I mean, 100,000 rats and just looking, opening them up and so forth, that once Blue came into the picture?
Exactly. They open up what they call the Rattery, which is a Victorian house on Fillmore Street, and they bring in as many rats as they can to try to trace the disease and how far it's spreading. They know that plague, when it reached other areas like Hong Kong, that it somehow has a strange ability to spread slowly and then spread almost like all at once. So they're trying to track the disease to see how close they are to the point where perhaps they have to quarantine all of San Francisco or all of California.
Well, the fear was also that it would go beyond San Francisco and California. It would become national. Yeah?
Exactly. And this was, you know, this is a time when people could move across the country faster than ever before. All it would take would be one person infected, and one infected person getting on a train heading east, and within a week, you could have the disease in, you know, Detroit and Chicago and Philadelphia, New York, and every other place along the line.
Talking, if you've just joined us, with David Randall, is the author of a book called Black Death at the Golden Gate. He's also senior reporter for Reuters. And I'm going to invite listeners to join us if you have some questions or if you have some comments about what we're talking about here, which is the Black Death at the Golden Gate, as his title suggests, and whole history that many people probably aren't all that well informed about, bubonic plague in San Francisco. And it was pretty devastating. And there's so much in this story about bigotry and about corruption and racism, as you might expect at that time. But if you want to know some of the nuances, or if you have some thoughts about it, or if you even have some reflections of your own, we'd like to hear from you. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. You can join us now. We invite you to do that. 866-733-6786 is the number to call. You can also join us by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or going to our website, kqed.org/forum. Click on the segment or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. What did they know at that time, David, about antibiotics?
They didn't know much. So penicillin was still, you know, a generation away. This was an era, what really was the doorstep of the modern age. Many of the things that we now take for granted, whether it's, you know, public sanitation or medicine or so many other things, really were still, those were still radical ideas.
Nothing about insect repellent, really, was there? DEET and all that sort of thing.
No, and they had no conception that that insects played such a part of the spread of the disease. They thought that, U.S. Surgeon General thought at the time that plague was just a disease of filth, so that if you poured boiling water over it, certain areas, it would go away.
But they were able to realize that it had to do with rats and fleas, ultimately.
Yeah, so that was through Rupert Blue. He was, you kind of think of all the things that they're best about San Francisco tech workers now, the idea of, you know, trying new things and a willingness to fail. He did all of those things in 1900 to attack this disease that seemed to have no cure.
There was also an outbreak around the time of the earthquake, wasn't there?
Exactly. So he essentially contained the first outbreak, which was in Chinatown. Then there was the great earthquake in 1906. The rats and the fleas start spreading to new areas, and suddenly the disease is across San Francisco, and he has to find a way to contain a disease throughout, you know, the various geographies of the city, whether it's, you know, forest or the beach or urban areas or stables and everything else.
They killed over 5 million rats.
Exactly. It was something like five times the number of the human population of the city.
Unbelievable. And then became plague-free finally around 1909. But how many deaths? About 75 deaths?
So there were over 200 deaths that they knew of. The big fear was that as health officials...
I was thinking about the earthquake time, though. There were about 75.
Oh, and yes.
Yeah. That a total since 1900, 200.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, go ahead, please.
One of the big fears in the first outbreak was that, you know, the health officer, Joseph Kenyon, was so aggressive that Chinese immigrants started hiding the bodies. They didn't want anybody to know that plague was truly there. So Kenyon had this fear that he knew the disease was spreading, and he felt like he was flying blind. He had no idea of how to contain it.
Take us back a little bit to the crab fishermen, too, because they discovered somebody just fell off of a couple of bodies that fell off a ship.
So this was a ship called the Nippon Maru, sails through the Golden Gate in early 1900. And someone dies on board who is a suspected plague case. Two other men on board also have start exhibiting signs of the disease, they're scared that they know that if they go to Angel Island, to the quarantine station, they have no idea what kind of freedom they're going to have. They jump overboard. They drown in the bay. A crab fisherman finds them, and it's a suspected plague case. This is the first danger that plague is there. They turn out not to be plague victims, but it starts throwing in motion all the other events that happen in the book.
You know, it's interesting to think how long people associated bubonic plague with filth and dirt and all those kinds of things, and yet had these extraordinary number of colonies of rats that were infested by fleas, and probably one could at least make the assumption that the filth and the dirt in places like Chinatown certainly were productive in terms of their producing.
That's right. There's a big urban rat population now. Over the last 10 years, urban rat populations have jumped by 15 to 20%. So this isn't something that's only confined to the past. There's more rats now for a combination of we have longer, hotter seasons, which leads to a longer breeding season, and more people live in urban areas, so there's just more trash and shelter for them.
I mentioned Mongolia before, and apparently, I don't know how much... you've done a lot of historical spade work writing this book, Black Death at the Golden Gate, but they were eating some raw marmot in Mongolia, I believe.
Exactly. So that's, it's related to squirrels. The same fleas feast on rats and squirrels and marmots and prairie dogs. So that's why the plague never left the U.S. The doctors were able to contain it and not have a human catastrophe, but the plague disease did get into the rural squirrel population. So that's why if you go to Yosemite today, there are signs saying beware of squirrels, they can carry plague. Prairie dog colonies in New Mexico have it. Something like 3 or 4 cases have been identified this calendar year already.
Again, I invite callers, if you want to know about this history or if you have some thoughts about it or know something about it, we welcome your involvement in the program, and you can join us toll-free at 866-733-6786. Here's Taylor. Taylor, you're on the air. Good morning.
Yes, good morning. I'm calling from Oakland here, and my question is, it's been a known history that Chinese people eat a lot of rats, and is that still going on, and was there a spread of bubonic from the consumption of rats?
What do we know about eating and ingestion of rats?
There wasn't any concern at the time of eating rats. One of the bigger concerns actually was later in the story. They realized that the disease has reached the squirrel population in Contra Costa County and Alameda, and they have to do a big push to tell people, you can no longer eat squirrels. They station people along the main tunnels and tell them, the danger of squirrel meat. And they also send a lot of veterans who are returning from the Spanish-American War out into the hillsides in Contra Costa with rifles and tell them, bring back as many dead squirrels as you can. And that's how they start tracking how far the disease starts spreading eastward.
Let me thank Taylor for the call, and let's go right to another caller, and that's you, Peter. You're on the air. Good morning.
Good morning. I just wanted to ask your guest, it's bad enough when you have a proximate cause like bubonic plague, but myself, I have a background in medical sciences myself, and I notice, when I step in something, I, calculate, is this thing radioactive or, something rushes up against me and it's wet. Why do we as humans have this fear of contagion? And have you come across anything in your studies, where people have actually focused on this as a study? And I just like somebody who could comment on it. It's a really strange phenomena. I know it's, warranted sometimes, but it is, boy, it is really a vicious two-edged sword.
Well, it's a good and important question, especially in light of, we're talking about real panic with respect to this Black Death.
Exactly. This was one of the most terrifying diseases in human history. This is a disease that wiped out half of the population in Europe in the 1300s or so. I think one of the reasons why people were so afraid of it, especially, you know, the 1900s and now, this was the era where they realized how diseases are spread. This was the time when, you know, germ theory and they discovered bacterium, and they realized that all these things, there are small living organisms that can attack you and go into your bloodstream in ways that you might not even recognize, and that the world is, you know, much more dangerous than we thought. It's not, you don't get a disease because of, you know, something internal with you. It's something out in the environment. And one of the things I took away from working on this book was that, you know, times change, but people don't necessarily change.
Well, people are still panicking about measles and mumps. And
exactly. So there are going to still be new public health dangers and panics. And sometimes we have to look towards the past to find out how we're going to navigate the future.
Let me draw you out, though, a little bit more about the impact of racism, especially on public health decisions that were made at this time.
So this was one of the things that really struck me when I was working on this book was that, you know, I kept on wondering, why aren't more people scared? You know, if they know plague is here, if there's even rumors plague is there, why aren't they freaking out? And one of the things was that many people in you know, the white community thought that Europeans somehow, or people with European ancestry, had somehow developed an immunity to the plague, that if you survived the plagues, or if your ancestors survived the plagues in Europe in the 1300s, you're fine now. And that was obviously ridiculous. But that was one reason why people weren't more scared. And it became all the disease became seen through a racial lens. It was, you know, if you are Asian, if you eat rice, then somehow you're more likely to get plague. But if, you know, if you're white and you eat meat, then you're not going to. So that went all the way up to the Surgeon General's office. You know, Ken Yoon, the public health officer and who was sent to San Francisco, you know, he knows the real danger. His boss does not, and thinks that he's just getting scared for no reason, that he's just paranoid. So he's, you know, really battling, you know, everyone around him and, you know, up and down as well.
Again, we're talking with David Randall. His book is Black Death at the Golden Gate. He's a senior reporter for Reuters. And our next caller joins us from Petaluma. Alexander, you're on the air. Good morning.
Yeah, hi. Fascinating program. I wonder if the racial aspect had something to do with the fact that Europeans were immune to some things that Native Americans weren't. But my question is, I'm getting bitten by fleas at night. And now I'm thinking my cat's interacting with the rats in my backyard. And now I got to worry, do I have to get checked for the plague now? Thanks. That's my question.
That actually is something that people will need to be checked for more and more. I was talking with a veterinary professor at UC Davis, which is, you know, one of the best vet schools in the world, and she was telling me that as, you know, climate changes and it's more conductive to rats and fleas, plague will start. The distribution of plague will start spreading in more places. So if you're in certain areas now, vets know to look for this. That, you know, if you're in New Mexico, plague is a well-known concern for cats and dogs. So vets check it right away. A danger can be that plague in the first 12 or 24 hours after you receive it or you catch it, it looks like a lot of other diseases. So you might not know to check until it's too late. It's kind of like Lyme disease.
I was going to say, it's very much like Lyme disease in that way, yeah.
Yeah, if you're, you know, I live outside of New York, Lyme disease is a very well-known fear. So as soon as your kids come in, you check them for ticks. And if they start having different symptoms, you check it right away.
Check your dogs and cats for fleas, too. Seriously. We'll take some more calls in just a moment. But here's Enrique, who says, Oakland also had an outbreak in the early 20th century with several fatalities. I understand it was a person making glove linings from ground squirrel pelts. Today, we have a lot of efforts by environmentalists to protect ground squirrels in the Berkeley waterfront area. We also have a huge homeless community in the same area. I can't imagine a worse recipe for disaster. And another listener, Kurt, wants to know, was bubonic plague imported from abroad? By the same token, were measles more recently imported from abroad?
So for the second one, yes. Plague had never been in North America before. It did come because this was the steamship age. So this was the first time when, you know, goods and people could travel across the world so quickly that the disease could, you know, diseased animals and people on ships could bring the disease here. And with the outbreak in Oakland, that was part of the same outbreak in the story. And the book goes into that as well. one of the fears at the time was, you know, where are the bodies going? And some of the bodies or the victims were going to Oakland. People were being essentially snuck out of Chinatown in the middle of the night. One of the issues, too, is, you know, we do talk so much about the dangers of you know, vaccinations, not the dangers of it, the dangers of under-vaccinations. And that's a big public health concern now. It's easy to forget at the same time how important sanitation is. And sanitation prevents many diseases from coming back that we thought were contained.
Yeah, I was just thinking also, many years ago, I read Journal of Plague Years, Samuel Pepys' book, and, you know, you do get the sense even back then of terrible panic people have. But not only the panic, the sense of the incomprehensibility of it and the feeling of, well, what can be done? I mean, it was just such an enigma.
Exactly. It was such a disease that was so overwhelming, and it seemed so quick, too, that, you know, somebody could contract the disease and die within 48 hours and really have no idea that how they got it.
And I'm just wondering also about what took you to this story. Why was it a fascination to you? It clearly comes through your narrative, your curiosity and fascination.
Well, I grew up in California. You know, I grew up in Riverside. I lived in Berkeley for a while. I never heard of this before. But then I was working on my last book, which tells the story about the family that used to own all of Malibu. And around the same time, one of the main characters comes up to San Francisco and he writes a letter back to his wife saying, you know, this is the wickedest place I've ever seen, and there's rumors that the plague is here. And I was really struck by the word rumors, because it seems like one of those things that you either know it or you wouldn't. And then I started doing research into it, and then I learned that it really was a conspiracy between city officials, the governor, and newspapers at the time to conceal the fact of the plague and put millions of people's lives at risk.
Yeah, there's a big greed factor in this, too, as one reads your book and discovers. David Kerr Randall is the author of Black Death at the Golden Gate, senior reporter for Reuters, and his other books include Dreamland and The King and Queen of Malibu, and this is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And we'll go to more of your calls for David Randall. We go next to a caller in the city. That's you, Tim. You're on the air.
Thank you. David, I actually live on the site that was the Rattery. So I had a question. I had read something about it being destroyed in a fire. Was the fire related to cleansing the area?
That's a great question, actually. I'll be honest, I don't know. I do know that many parts of the city that had been connected with plague were burned. And it was one of those things where they didn't necessarily know how effective fire would be, but it almost seemed to satisfy some urge that maybe we can cleanse this away and we never have to think about it again.
Fire purifies.
Yeah, exactly. There was actually even a superstition going back to the Middle Ages that if you could burn soil, that it would also burn the plague away. So during one of the outbreaks, when health officials and doctors would go into basements looking for rats, it was very common for people to pick up some of the soil and burn it as if that was, you know, something that would protect them.
Let me thank you for the call, Tim. Good to hear from you. Appreciate the call. And we'll go to another caller. And this other caller is Baum. Good morning.
Morning. Since you got us all scared, why don't you explain to us what the early symptoms are of the plague and early, later, and also what the cure is?
That's a great question. So the first 12 hours or so, it looks a lot like just a bad flu, you know, high fever, bad headache, body aches, everything else. Then it's over the next 24 to 48 hours where it becomes a very serious disease. That's when you start, you can see a bubo emerging. And as somebody goes through the plague, it's really the worst experience that you can have. It's diarrhea, it's vomiting, it's delusions. Blood might start foaming out of your mouth. It's a gruesome fate.
It's gruesome even to read about it, I got to tell you, but you get the details down. He was asking about ways to cure the plague, and we're talking about antibiotics mainly, aren't we?
Exactly. It is, you know, antibiotics can cure the plague. It's a powerful dose. You know, this is not a Z-pack. You're not going to feel fine in 2 days, but it will, it's treatable if you are treated in time. That's the big caveat there.
Streptomycin. That's the key, I think. And let me thank the caller, and we'll go to another caller here. We're going to go to San Anselmo next and welcome Joe. Joe, you're on.
Hi. My sweetheart is from Siberia, and she claims that they never had the plague there because they're so neat and clean.
It's so cold, too.
Well, not necessarily in the summertime, but what they do is they clean the streets and the dust and everything, and everybody, including her, she wouldn't like it if I was saying this, but is impeccably clean. I mean, everything has to be laundered, and she claims that's the reason why Russia and Siberia escaped from the plague.
It's a hard one to determine, I would imagine, David Randall, but sanitation of all kinds and cleanliness certainly helps, right?
Exactly. So the big issue is you know, treating rats and fleas that can and spread it. What happened in San Francisco was this was really the dawn of the idea of public sanitation. This was part of an era where, you know, cities before were incredibly filthy, and it wasn't only San Francisco. In New York, in the meatpacking district, you know, the blood from slaughtered animals would leak out into the sidewalk, and you know, you'd see teenagers who would, you'd pay them a nickel and they'd sweep a path through the blood for you. What the plague fight in San Francisco really did was accelerated those ideas that, you know, we can maintain a city environment that is fit for people and that millions of people can live in with, that can be relatively free from disease. So you know, Rupert Blue, he pioneered things that seem common sense now, like street sweeping and rat-proofing trash cans and concrete sidewalks so rat burrows can't get underneath. But these were all incredibly radical ideas at the time.
David, it's good to have you with us and to learn this piece of history that, as I said, probably many people didn't know about. And you can learn more about it in David's book. David Randall's the author. It's called Black Death at the Golden Gate, and he's a senior reporter with Reuters. Thank you for being with us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
And we are going to be back with you for another hour of Forum. When we return, we're going to actually talk about this bill outlawing nearly all abortions in Alabama and what that means in terms of the pro-life movement and what it's trying to do in terms of really getting in front of the Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court. And Andrew Curran will be joining us. He's the author of a book on Diderot, one of the great philosophers from the Enlightenment. That's all up ahead on Forum after the news. Stay tuned. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, which preserves the legacy of renowned artists such as Wayne Thiebaud for future innovators by dedicating a third of its space to arts education.